broadcasting live from atop the Rocky Mountains, the crossroads of the West. You are listening to the Liberty Roundtable Radio Talk Show.
All right. Happy to have you along, my fellow Americans. Sam Bushman live on your radio. Hard-hitting news that outrage reviews to use, no doubt, starts now. This, my fellow Americans, is the broadcast for November the 20th in the year of our Lord, 2023. This is Hour 2 at 2, the goal always to protect life, liberty, and property, to promote God, family, and country, to do so on your radio in the traditions of our founding fathers. And boy, howdy, do we have our work cut out for us as we use the supreme law of the land every time, ladies and gentlemen. We got a lot of work to do, a lot of time to spend, and we'll absolutely spend it wisely, ladies and gentlemen. By the way, last week we had on Lowell Nelson, and we talked about so many great things. We talked about, don't worry, it's not foreign aid, it's corporate welfare. Ron Paul, Rockwell.com, doing a great job. We talked about unconstitutional killings. Judge Napolitano, amen to that, as we stand against war and for peace. We talked about false virtue, life and death, the life and death of American exceptionalism, Thomas DiLorenzo. We talked about more than 12,000 entities were under sanction by the, quote, U.S. Treasury. It's out of control. We talked about Forgotten American Stories by Lydia Nuttall, doing a great job as always. We talked about chapter 2 of her book about the Statue of Liberty. Well, folks, we have a lot of the same people in our discussion today, but this just shows how prolific they are, what kind of context they bring to the table, how valuable the work they do really is. Lowell Nelson, welcome back to Liberty Roundtable Live, sir.
Thanks for having me, Sam. I appreciate this opportunity very much. It is a lineup that reflects or mirrors what we did last week, but their topics are so good, they're so relevant that I just couldn't resist, picking up their columns and discussing them again.
Well, and I highlight that because of how prolific they are. And the reason that I really bring this up and spend the time highlighting last time and now this time is because you've got to go to ronpaulinstitute.org. You've got to go to campaignforliberty.org. You've got to go to lourockwell.com. You've got to go to some of these places because, man, that's where these authors hang out and write their incredible prose. We kick it off again with another zinger, if you will, from Ron Paul. Quote, no, Janet, we cannot afford more wars. Boy, howdy, is that spot on, Lowell.
I'll say, and he titled his column that because recently Janet Yellen, former Fed chief, basically, she commented that America can and must fund both the war in Ukraine and the war in Israel. Well, so in his email, Ron Paul is responding to Janet saying, we can't afford to fund either war, let alone both of them. Bloomberg Intelligence recently released an analysis showing that a year of interest payments on the national debt now exceeds $1 trillion. Well, this should have been a wake-up call to Congress and the Biden administration, but it was largely ignored, as you might expect. As a former Fed chief, Ron Paul writes, Yellen no doubt thinks it does not matter how much the U.S. government spends as long as the Fed can monetize the debt. Monetizing federal debt requires the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates low. These low rates incentivize government, businesses, and private citizens to take on large amounts of debt. This may not be a problem as long as the central bank keeps rates low. However, once the central bank raises rates, many individuals, businesses, and even governments will be unable to manage their debt. Businesses will also learn they were misled by the low rates into making unwise investments, creating a short-term boom, a bubble, and then a crash. End of quote. So there we have it, Sam. A very good explanation of the boom-bust cycle that's precipitated by government interventionism in the marketplace.
And let's be clear, we see this over and over and over, though. So you know what? You can't say that it's his opinion. It is a historical, documented, reality-based pattern, Lowell.
Very true. Congress continues to spend money on war and on welfare, more money each year than they can raise in taxes each year. You know, just several years ago, they would raise $3 trillion in taxes but spend $4 trillion in spending on war and welfare. So that's an unsustainable trend because it leads to massive deficits and a bubble that must eventually burst, which can only be followed by an economic crisis. Continuing on his column, he writes this, quote, "The only reason the government bubble has not yet burst is that the dollar remains the world's reserve currency. However, the dollar could soon lose that status. A collapse of the U.S. dollar empire would benefit people in countries like Ukraine and Israel because it would allow them to work for peaceful relations with their neighbors instead of having their interests sacrificed for the profits of the U.S. military-industrial complex." End of quote. Wow. I mean, that is a profound statement, Sam. This, basically, if the dollar were not the world reserve currency, then this bubble would have burst long time ago. But because it is the world reserve currency, although it's losing that status steadily now for the past couple of years, and it will continue to lose its status until a final collapse, because of that, the U.S. dollar empire is going to disappear, and that's going to be good. You know, we might be hurt. Anybody who's holding Federal Reserve notes will be hurt, but just think of the good it will do the countries like Ukraine and Israel, because they are not going to be pawns to the U.S. government empire anymore. They're going to have to fend for themselves, and they're going to have to work for peace, peaceful relations with their neighbors.
Imagine that as the catalyst, and then America being a light on a hill, encouraging, teaching, educating, inviting, humbly pleading, exhorting people around the world to follow the Prince of Peace. Imagine those two together, Lowell.
Wow, that would be very powerful. And that's why I used to dread the collapse of the dollar. But now I'm kind of cheering it on because I think it would signal the end of the U.S. empire, which means that there would be fewer wars in which we're engaged, so less killing. I don't know. It just seems to me like it'd be an all-around good thing. I think we mentioned the broken window.
It would be a good
thing
if we could tie them to hard currency where they didn't have the ability to play games. If we move from the U.S. dollar to a global digital currency of some kind, some kind of a crypto or some kind of other thing, all it will do is accelerate the dishonesty, because then they can just, like 1984, just fudge the numbers even more than they're already doing. So we need to be careful what we go to, but your point's well taken.
Now, last week I mentioned the broken window fallacy, or basically the seen and the unseen. Put simply, a dollar spent in creating weapons of war is a dollar that is not spent creating products and services that meet consumers' needs and wants. So Ron Paul has a solution, Sam. Quote, "The only way to avoid a dollar crisis followed by an economic meltdown is for Congress to stop pouring money into a futile attempt to run the world and instead pursue a policy of peace and free trade with all. This will not only benefit the American people, but people around the globe. Ending the warfare state will free up resources that can be used to support those truly dependent on government programs while we unwind the welfare state and transfer to local charities and religious institutions responsibility for aid to those in need. The American people's liberty and prosperity will never be safe from power-hungry politicians and self-anointed world saviors until the income tax is repealed and the Fed is audited and ended." End of quote. How's that for a profound prophetic statement, Sam?
Well, I think it really highlights what's important for us to really keep an eye on the ball, Lowell, is what I would say. Right? Yeah. I mean, isn't this about keeping an eye on the ball? Most people are just so distracted now, they don't even know They don't even realize there's a ball. Much less keep an eye on it, lol.
You got that right.
I don't mean to be offensive. I'm just saying I believe this, though. They don't even know where to look for real answers, well, right?
It's like 1 in 1,000 can correctly identify the problem with our fiat monetary system. 1 in 1,000. I mean, that's not very good odds. Now, I think we've made a lot of headway since Ron Paul's run in 2007 and the endless chance to end the Fed at every gathering at which he spoke. I think that did wonders. I think there's a lot of people now who understand. It's not 1 in 1,000 anymore. It's probably maybe 1 in 100, maybe 1 in 10 people now understand the problem with our fiat monetary system.
Well,
that
even if they don't completely understand the problem, I think people realize something's wrong and know it needs to change. That doesn't mean they can dig in and explain it like you or I might be able to do, but they know something's wrong and they know that's at the core of it.
Absolutely right. And I welcome that newfound knowledge, all the wonderful people who understand this concept now. They're against the CBDC. They're against fiat monetary system. They recognize the value of gold and silver specie. And we have a lot of states now, Sam, that are introducing, you know, gold and silver coin and even gold backs into their states as an alternative currency. And I applaud that movement.
Amen to that. Not only that, 46, I think it was, senators stood up and said we need to audit the Fed. That's more than we've ever had before. We're gaining ground. Never lose hope, ladies and gentlemen. Quick pause. Lowell Nelson, campaignforliberty.org, RonPaulInstitute.org. You are listening to Liberty Roundtable live.
Do you treasure your liberty? Well, at LovingLiberty.net, we most certainly do. And we want to help protect your liberty, too. Become part of the family. Everyone knows that the core of any society is the family. Therefore, the government should foster and protect the integrity of its family, we the people. Won't you join us as a Loving Liberty sponsor to help us promote the principles in the 5,000-year leap? Let's restore the miracle that changed the world at LovingLiberty.net.
As you are aware, America is divided over every fault line possible. This is intentionally fostered by those who do not love God, family, or country. We believe a peaceful future as a free people absolutely depends on civility. Clarion Call for Civility is looking for funding and volunteers at every level to make our hopes and efforts a reality. Please donate, sign our pledge, and help us in our sacred cause. Please visit callforcivility.com for more details. callforcivility.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Lowell Nelson, a guest on Sam Bushman's show this morning, Liberty Roundtable Live. We've been talking about Ron Paul's profound column about the liberty and prosperity of the American people. We'll never be safe from power-hungry politicians and self-anointed world saviors until the income tax is repealed and the Fed is audited and ended. Profound words from Ron Paul. Now let's hasten on in our discussion this morning to a column by Judge Andrew Napolitano entitled, Whatever Happened to the Freedom of Speech? You can find this column at RonPaulInstitute.org. He has a great column. In the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, he says, we read, quote, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, end of quote. Now, of course, there are five freedoms mentioned in the First Amendment, as you all know, religion, speech, press, assembly, and petition. But Judge Knapp focuses on the freedom of speech in this particular column. He begins by asking a very telling question, quote, if the states ratified an amendment to the Constitution that repealed the First Amendment, would we still enjoy the freedom of speech? End of quote. And then he answers that question with another question, quote, are our rights only what lawmakers have written down, or are they personal attributes immune from governmental reach? End quote. And then he answers this both of these questions this way. He says, quote, the First Amendment is a negative right. It does not grant the freedom of speech. It negates Congress from abridging it. End of quote. And so there you have it, folks. Sam, in fact, this is why I like to call the first 10 amendments to the Constitution the list of prohibitions, because they're really not a list of our rights. They are a list of prohibitions on what the general government may not do. That's why I call them the list of prohibitions, right? I mean, if you look at First Amendment, for example, it says Congress shall make no law that, you know, respecting religion or speech, press, assembly, and petition, right, that adversely affects those freedoms. And so, you know, each one of our amendments to the Constitution just states more clearly what the general government may not do. And then Judge Knapp
explains. Yeah, what I like to call them, just before you go on, I like to call them the untouchables.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, look, yeah. God gave them to us, and God said governments are instituted among men for the blessings of us all. If you go look at Scripture, you'll understand this. However, these things are untouchable, government. So, yes, you have limited authority. Yes, you have appropriate power to protect us all and to support our God-given rights. That's your purpose. Okay? There is a collective. I'm for the individual, but there is a collective element to, go read Bastier's The Law if you want to debate me on this. But there is a collective reality. And government, these are your untouchables. God gave them to us. My right of free speech, my right of the free exercise of religion, my right of, and I can go through all five, my right of a redress of grievance, my right to peacefully assemble. Okay, all these things, the right of the freedom of the press, all these things are given to me by God. And government, no touchy. That's all you got to know. Lol.
Yeah, I like that. No touchy. From that Disney movie about the Aztec llama. Llama face.
That's right.
Yeah.
No touchy.
You're exactly right. No touchy. I like that. Untouchables. Very good. List of prohibitions, untouchables. Now, Judge Knapp then explains what you just said, Sam, that a right does not come from government, but from God. Quote, it belongs to every human by virtue of our existence. Rights come from our humanity. End of quote. Privileges, on the other hand, such as voting in an election or driving an automobile on a government roadway, yeah, those come from government. They can be granted or revoked by the government, right? Well, another way to look at this is to ask a question. If laws against murder were repealed, would it be okay to murder someone? Well, of course not, because murder is wrong under natural law. And so with regard to the freedom of speech under natural law, the freedom of speech is a natural human right and is immune from government interference, whether the prohibition on interference is written down or not. So Judge Napolitano then asks and answers another important question. Quote, is natural law in the Constitution? Yes, he writes, the Ninth Amendment, Madison's crown jewel, recognizes the existence of personal human rights too numerous to articulate, and it prohibits the government from denying or disparaging them. End of quote. And so really the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, Sam, those two amendments are really both crown jewels. It basically, the Ninth Amendment says, look, if it's not written down, then you can't touch it, right? Only those things enumerated in the Constitution are powers that the general government may exercise. Everything else is untouchable, no touchy. Then he continues, quote, the opposite of natural law is positivism. It teaches that law is only that which has been written down and ratified by the lawgiver. Under positivism, there is no natural law restraint upon the government. Right and wrong are only and always whatever the government says they are. End quote. Well, you know, positivism is a morally indefensible position, in my opinion, Sam. I have always distinguished between lawful and legal. Right? For example, are income taxes lawful? No way. But they are legal because the government says they are legal. But they are not lawful because they steal money from taxpayers at gunpoint. And that, Sam, that's immoral. That's dishonest. That's wrong.
You got that right. Let me give you another example to make the point even more poignant.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this, but In the old days, government got involved in marriage. I don't know if you know how the federal government got involved in marriage, but they shouldn't have been involved in it at all. It used to be to where you'd write it down in your Bible, your local preacher, your local pastor. It was a very local thing. You document it in the Bible. That was good enough. Eventually, the government got involved. The federal government got involved in marriage. And the reason they did is because they didn't want black people marrying white people. So the government came out racist and stopped black and white marriages by government mandate. I would say to you that was, quote, legal at the time, but it certainly wasn't lawful. Now, this is interesting because they call me a racist. Now I'm calling the government racist, and I'm telling you that you know what? God's children can marry each other, and that's up to God, not government. But government got involved because they were racist. Lol, let's be very clear about who's the racists, okay?
Great point, Sam. In fact, my senior essay, before I graduated from the university, the Brigham Young University, was on that very topic, miscegenation. That's what they called it. When the mixing of the races is called miscegenation. And so the U.S. government came out with, and states also came out with a flurry of laws against miscegenation. So Sam is exactly right. It was the government who is racist in this matter. They wanted to prevent the mixing of the races and thereby disclose the fact that they truly were racist. And that happened in
the colonial
period.
And now I call them out on it, and they want to run around and say, I'm a racist. These people are crazy.
So returning to the column by Judge Andrew Napolitano, he writes, quote, "Today, the government thinks very little of the freedom of speech, even though everyone in government, from the president on down to a part-time government janitor, they've sworn allegiance to the Constitution." That's so true, right? The oath that they take. Now, as evidence of the government's indifference toward this prohibition on its authority, Judge Knapp gives several examples. Quote, "Last month in Illinois, a newspaper reporter was criminally charged with interfering with a government function because he asked a city official at a public meeting too many questions for the official's comfort level." Imagine that. And then last week in Alabama, a publisher and reporter were arrested for disclosing grand jury evidence, which they lawfully possessed. Third example, recently in Philadelphia, a former New Jersey state senator was kicked out of a stadium owned by the government for displaying and refusing to remove American and Israeli flags at an Eagles game, right? The Philadelphia Eagles. That's amazing. So in summary, he writes, "On all over American college campuses today, each side in the Israeli-Hamas public relations war wants the government to silence the other side because, each claims, the speech is dangerous or untruthful." End of quote. So my question to you, Sam, whatever has happened with the freedom of speech? Wow. You know, because these values underlying free speech, they're in a unanimous Supreme Court decision in 1969. How many years ago is that? Just, what, 55 years ago? Called Brandenburg versus Ohio, which says that, quote, "All innocuous speech, even speech encouraging violence or hatred, is absolutely protected, and all speech is innocuous when there is time for more speech to challenge it," end of quote. And there,
well,
I think,
amen. And here's my question or point. Mm-hmm. You know what? I believe freedom of speech is the free forum of ideas. All right. And mm-hmm. everybody can advocate for what they want to. We need to have enough trust in the American people that if they can listen and everybody gets a chance to kind of say what they want to say and openly debate it, discuss it, make their pros, their cons, their arguments, I believe the American people with full information can make the right decisions. The majority of the people will vote and will act right most of the time if the people are righteous. If the people are wicked, then they will vote wrongly and we're in serious trouble then. But in the meantime, I rely on this openness of free speech. And my question to those who want to limit it or stop it or prosecute because of it, here's my question. What are they afraid of? Let's have Lowell respond to that in seconds on your radio. We'll be right back.
Daily Liberty Newswire. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
USA News, I'm Corey Myers. Intense negotiations underway on a possible deal to release dozens of hostages held by Hamas.
Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer on NBC's Meet the Press said it's the closest they've come to reaching an agreement. Finer cautioned that nothing has been finalized, but some of the hostages could be released in exchange for a pause in fighting. Hamas took about 240 people as hostages, including several Americans, during its deadly October 7th attack on Israel. I'm Dave Collins.
Authorities say crews have extinguished a train fire in Atlanta. Authorities did not immediately release any information about if anyone was hurt in that derailment. The fire happening after a Norfolk Southern train crashed into a CSX train at around 6:30 a.m., causing 8 CSX train cars to go off the rails. Reactions have begun to pour in following the death of former First Lady Rosalynn Carter.
Known for her efforts on mental health and caregiving and women's rights. So I hope that during the holidays, you'll consider saying include the Carter family in your prayers.
Current First Lady Jill Biden remembering her while meeting with service members and other families in Virginia. Rosalynn Carter passing away yesterday afternoon at the age of 96. Speaker Mike Johnson said he will release more than 40,000 hours of footage taken at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th of 2021 when protesters stormed the halls of Congress because they were angry about the 2020 election. Some video already available. The rest of it will be released gradually over time. Johnson shared the link to the public website on his X page Friday afternoon. This is USA News.
Attention timeshare owners. Tired of the financial stress? Were you misled by the salesperson? Don't or can't use your timeshare anymore? If any of these apply to you, then you may qualify for timeshare cancellation and get the relief you need now. Timeshare Defense Attorneys is the number one affordable fixed fee legal solution in the country with an A+ Better Business Bureau rating. That's certainly better than my grades. They even offer a 100% client satisfaction guarantee. Let one of their experienced lawyers evaluate your case and explain the process. If they take you as a client, they'll work on your case until it's resolved in your favor, guaranteed. Expect great service and a close working relationship with your lawyer, keeping you informed every step of the way, protecting your rights, interests, and even your credit. It's that simple. Even a kid like me can understand it. The consultation is free. Call today.
800-875-1853. 800-875-1853. That's 800-875-1853.
Good to be with you this morning, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Bushman, your host on Liberty Roundtable Live. My name is Lowell Nelson, his guest this morning, this hour. We've been talking about this awesome column by Judge Andrew Napolitano about the freedom of speech and whatever happened to it before the break. As Sam asked the question, so what are they afraid of, right? What are they afraid of when, I'll answer that question right now. They're afraid that the truth will come out. That's what they're afraid of. If big media and if big government, if they allow equal time for the truth, then they will be found out. They'll be exposed, right? So a tyrannical government will always attempt to control the narrative. That's what they're trying to do. That's what's happened to free speech. We are we're being oppressed by a tyrannical regime that wants to control the narrative, and that's there's great danger ahead for us folks if we allow that to happen. Judge Knapp writes this. He says this analysis is not about speech in your living room. It is about public speech in public places. That is the speech, no matter how caustic or distasteful or provocative, that the First Amendment was written to protect. Even erroneous speech, such as 2 + 2 = 22, even that speech is protected. We all have the natural right to pursue happiness, but no one can be truly happy if they're afraid to speak his or her mind. Well, that is so very, very true. Judge Andrew Napolitano ends his column with a quote from John Stuart Mill. If all mankind minus one were of one opinion and only one person were of the contrary opinion, mankind would be no more justified in silencing that one person than he, that one person, if he had the power, would be justified in silencing mankind. End of quote. So Sam, when I was a young man, America embraced the freedom of speech. And we need to remember that the First Amendment prohibits the general government from abridging that freedom. We must not allow the general government and institutions sponsored or supported by the general government to abridge this very important freedom. Sam?
Amen to that. You and I should have our free speech, and so should Julian Assange, sir.
You got that right, because here is a real live case where a lawful act was declared illegal by the general government, and now someone is facing severe penalties and has already suffered very severe penalties for doing something lawful. So Adam Dick wrote this article, and it's posted at ronpaulinstitute.org. And what he did, he reminded us that last month he reported that the U.S. House of Representatives members Jim McGovern, a Democrat from Massachusetts, and also Thomas Massie, a Republican from Kentucky, that they were gathering signatures from other House members for a letter to President Joe Biden. The letter asks the president to drop both the U.S. government's requested extradition and its ongoing prosecution efforts in regard to Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. So, last week, Massie and McGovern, along with 13 other representatives and Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, they sent the letter to Biden. Quote, U.S. elected officials have previously called on the administration to drop the charges against Mr. Assange, including in April of this year when members of the House argued that every day that the prosecution of Julian Assange continues is another day that our own government needlessly undermines our own moral authority abroad and rolls back the freedom of the press under the First Amendment here at home. End of quote. So the letter that they sent Joe Biden last week concludes with the following statement, quote, it is the duty of journalists to seek out sources, including documentary evidence, in order to report to the public on the activities of government. The United States must not pursue an unnecessary prosecution that risks criminalizing common journalistic practices and thus chilling the work of the free press. We urge you to ensure that this case be brought to a close in as timely a manner as possible. End of quote.
And sadly, even Donald had the chance and failed at it. Donald ran around, said he was going to, loosen the libel slander laws and everything else so that we'd all be able to sue and make a lot of money and everything else. Boy, have I been abused by that. But even Julian Assange, Donald could have got that done and didn't. He missed the opportunity, lol.
Well, guess which representatives did not co-sign that letter, Sam? Take a guess.
Utah's.
Yep. Not a single member of Congress from Utah co-signed that letter to Biden. Now I'm assuming each was invited to do so, but that is only a mere assumption, folks. I have no evidence whatsoever that each of the six members of Congress from Utah were asked to co-sign that letter.
Well, if they listen to this radio program, then they can go ahead and tell their congressmen and senators, and then they can go ahead and call up, the leaders of this. Right. And say, hey, I want to be on this. So there's still opportunity, folks.
Absolutely. And I am also wondering, Sam, maybe we citizens have not put enough pressure on the six Utah members of Congress to get this issue on their top 10 issues list. I mean, so
Amen.
I think we bear some responsibility for this.
Agreed.
I mean, if I'm not calling my congressman and asking them to co-sign this letter, then part of the blame rests with me.
No doubt.
We need to do a better job on that, folks. But I just find this prosecution of Julian Assange reprehensible, Sam. We should not
Amen.
Be, chilling freedom of the press, which is what we're doing when we allow our government to prosecute the WikiLeaks guys, Julian Assange, for simply disclosing to the American public what the government should have disclosed in the first place.
And
we were killing civilians. Yeah, yeah. And so,
the bottom line is they released truth, and now they're being basically prosecuted for telling the truth. As Ron Paul says, telling the truth today is a revolutionary act. Tragic but true. Hey, Lola, are you into the alkafluence of alcohol, sir?
No way, man. No way. But that is certainly a big issue here in Highland. Let me tell you what. Last
in
night,
Highland, Utah, ladies and gentlemen, so people don't
Highland,
know
Utah.
What you're talking about, right?
Right, right. And so you, if you live in a state other than Utah, if you live in a city other than Highland, don't go to sleep because I'm going to make a point here, and you got to listen. Last night, Sam, while preparing my notes for today's show, I received a call from a neighbor, a good neighbor, good friend, just two or three houses away, asking about the candidates for city council here in our municipal elections. Now, most voters in other states have already voted in the November general election, but here in Utah, our election day was delayed 2 weeks from November 7 to November 21, meaning tomorrow. Tomorrow is the last day and is truly our election day here in Utah. But this neighbor asked me about the hot topic in Highland right now, and that is whether the city will allow restaurant owners in Highland to sell alcohol. Currently, the sale of alcohol is not permitted in the city of Highland, except in a couple of businesses that pre-existed the incorporation of the city of Highland, which was incorporated in July of 77. Well, those two businesses, they were grandfathered into the city because, see, they were selling alcohol already under the auspices of the county because this was county property before the city was incorporated. But once it was incorporated, the city said no more alcohol sales are permitted in the city except at these two businesses. Well, the city of Highland then sent a survey to residents asking how they felt about the sale of alcohol, and almost two-thirds of the respondents were okay with it. Now, the reason I broached this topic, Sam, is to discuss the survey, not to tell you how I feel about the sale of alcohol. The survey is not a statistically valid survey. The results came from people who responded. So the results reflect only those people who responded, which is not a representative sample of the residents of the city of Highland. So, Sam, I just want everyone to understand that for a survey to be statistically valid, it must be a random survey, and the sample size must be sufficiently large. So if those two criteria are not met, then the survey cannot be considered as representative of the residents of the city. So, folks, I begged you to listen
but
to this, even though
I reject surveys in the first place, though, Lowell.
Okay. And why is that?
The reason I do is because you can make anything you want to say with analytics. You can make anything you want to say with surveys. You can make anything. If I do a query, a poll, a survey, or whatever word you want to use for this, I can word the questions and I can do things to make sure that it comes out the way that I want it to 9 times out of 10. And I can make sure, even if I can't get it to say what I want to because the sampling is so small, I can muddy the waters with this. So the real question comes down to several issues in my mind. Number one. All right. They consider alcohol sales permits. Do you believe the government should be able to control who can and who can't sell alcohol, first of all?
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, do you believe, let's go ahead and skip the break entirely. Do you believe that the government not only can pick winners and losers in that discussion, but that the government has control? Because if it's alcohol, then what about cigarettes? If it's cigarettes, what about candy? What about soda pop? In some of these whacked out liberal cities, they're like, hey, you can't buy a big soda pop more than so many ounces and stuff like that. Or you can't buy junk food. Or where does this end when you let the government do this? So between you and me, I'm not for prohibition. And I'm not for government promoting alcohol either. Because when government promotes alcohol, 9 times out of 10, government participates in the spoils. So I'm kind of the guy that says, let's not make it legal or illegal. Let's just have government get out of it. And people would say, well, Sam, that's crazy. I don't think so. You've already got a crazy scenario where the government's getting rich on alcohol sales. Okay? So how is it crazy? You got dry counties, and you got this, and you got that, and you got this hodgepodge of government authority. Government's already got too much authority over too many things, lol. So you know what? I don't think that we need surveys. I don't think we need to play games with this. And I don't think we need to say government instantly just has that authority to decide that in the first place. Who gave them the authority to decide that?
Well, it's like, do I have the moral authority, Sam, to walk over to your house and prohibit you from drinking alcohol? Do I, as your neighbor, have that authority?
No, I want to be Uncle Hiram in the basement, and I can do that, you know?
Okay. And so say you have a restaurant. Now you're a proprietor of a restaurant. Do I have the moral authority to command you, to prohibit you from selling alcohol in your restaurant?
No, you can influence me with your kind and better judgment. Say, Sam, look, this is getting out of hand, and you can influence me to the best of your ability. You can even create compromises that I can agree with. There's ways to work through this together. But do you assume that you have somehow authority over the with a government gun to my head to force me to do or not do things? I don't know where you got that authority from, because I don't have it. That means you don't.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate here for a moment, Sam. In my family, I'm choosing not to have alcohol here in my home. And it turns out that everybody on my street, that's my right. Everybody here on our street feels the very same way. So, I mean, in our subdivision, we don't allow anybody to have alcohol. You know, we agreed upon that in covenants, right? And so according to the covenants in my subdivision, we don't allow alcohol. And that's kind of a family value, a community value, basically, right? So does now say that I get two or three subdivisions to agree to that. Maybe I get a whole community to agree to that. Does my community have the authority to ban the sale of alcohol in our community because we have embraced that as a community value?
And my view is no, because if I buy a piece of property, it's now my property.
Excellent.
It's mine. It's not yours. And if you say that you give that restriction, then here's the next question. What other restrictions can you put? Sam, you have to have trees that are, this trimmed, and Sam, you have to have this, and Sam, and that's what we've got to in America, and they call them covenants. What if you say, you know what, you can't live here unless you're a certain age? They do that now, too. Oh, man, if you're 46, you can't live here, but if you're 50, you can. Oh, you can't. Okay, folks, this has got to stop. At what point you got a hierarchy of rights and a hierarchy of morality here? And on this, what you do is you take these isolated examples and you upset the moral hierarchy here. Yes, I believe alcohol's bad, and I don't have alcohol in my house either. However, for me to suggest that you can't means I have authority over you. Where does that authority stop? Now that we've started the list, let's just add to the list, right? That's the danger. That's the problem. So I'm not for alcohol, and I'm not advocating for alcohol sales or permits or anything else. What I am saying is the government's not the arbiter. They don't have authority. And we, the people, can't exert authority over another that we do not have, Lowell. I'm sticking with the principle through and through, sir.
All right. Here's another question from the devil's advocate. When you bought that property, Sam, you knew that there was a restriction on the use of that property, right? Because everybody in my subdivision had agreed.
I accepted that you guys pretended you had a restriction. You can't control the property of another. So look, Larry lives in the house, and he agreed to your restriction. I buy it from Larry, and I'm Sam. I'm not Larry. Larry agreed to the restriction on his property. I am not bound by Larry's agreement.
Interesting, because in my subdivision, we had all agreed that we would not subdivide our property to less than 1 acre. And there was a case just two or three, maybe 5 or 6 years ago now, where one of the neighbors wanted to subdivide his property, but then, in rereading the covenants of the subdivision, we pointed out that he can't do that, and so he had to sell and leave because he didn't get his way.
Yep, and I think he should be able to divide his property. It's his now. If he's doing something that's hazardous that starts to encroach on your rights, now we're talking about something else. But see, I don't agree that you can't divide property. I know that's the rules, and I know that's the way it is in a lot of places. I just disagree with the premise based on principle.
Interesting. Yeah. Well,
because otherwise
good discussion
we say,
what?
You can't have a house smaller than 5,000 square feet. And by the way, we don't like your wood fence or your whatever. Sir, you have to have a vinyl fence at your house. And by the way, you know what? Your lawn mowing guy cuts his lawn on 3. Everybody else has theirs at 2. And you need your lawn to be shorter. Do you got that? Okay. Where does this end, Lowell?
Well, no, no. I see. That's ex post facto. If you buy a piece of property and then we change the rules on you, that's ex post facto. That's untenable. You can't do that.
What if we all agree that ex post facto is fine?
Well, yeah. If that's the agreement you walk in with, then you can change them. But the covenants are not written that way, at least in my subdivision. So, if a person buys property in my subdivision, they agree to the covenants that are already in place, and we don't change those. They just were set in stone like 20, 30, 40, I guess 71 years, quite a while ago, and that's what we live by today. So those don't change. So I agree that we can't add new things to the covenants at will, that whim, because that's just whimsical. But the covenants that are in place and have been in place for decades, that's what we go by in my subdivision. And I'm a property owner. I bought into it. Yeah.
I get the point. I just reject it and disagree with it, because when you buy into it, you're suggesting that you have some by paper agreement from previous people that this is the way it's going to be. And then what if somebody ever wants to change it? Well, then what they do is they go to the covenant board, or usually the HOA association, and what they do is they lobby to change it. And then if enough people decide to change it, they do. See, you've gone down this road that eventually you'll be a serf on your own property, buddy.
Yep. Yeah, I see where you're coming from, Sam. I do.
Because what if I buy the majority of the properties in your neighborhood and decide I'm just going to do high-rises and stores and shopping malls? And then you say no, and I twist everybody's arms and I change the covenants. And I say, buddy, you're the minority here. I'm voting against you. Yeah. Now what do you do?
I'm moving. I'm leaving town, man.
See, so I'm just saying it's that kind of problem. Folks, we've got to understand there are God-given inalienable rights, and it all relates to life, liberty, and property. And whenever you start to encroach on those things, I'm not saying there's never exceptions, but rarely do exceptions make sense. Rarely does it work. And back in the day, they understood this stuff, and that's why old cities look kind of hodgepodge-ish and don't look great, because they respected property, and therefore, it was what it was. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes perfect sense, Sam. And yeah, I'm old school. I like that.
And I'd rather have my property look, you know, I'd rather have the neighbors next door kind of have some trashy property than have a beautiful neighborhood that's tyrannical in nature. Anyway, back in the day, we respect all these things, including free speech and property rights and everything else. These days, they're getting literally destroyed. So anyway, what do you say on the alcohol sales? You're voting yes or no, or what do you say?
Well, yeah, so I don't get a vote on it. Only the city council gets a vote on it. But I'm voting for the city council candidates who are voting against the alcohol sales in Highland. Because I believe that's a community value. But the whole point of this particular point, Sam, is to be careful about surveys. And you've explained why you can't trust surveys, and I've explained why, you know, you got to make sure they're random. You have to find out how the survey was conducted, because anything can be twisted. Is the sample size large enough? I mean, all of these factors come into play here. So don't trust surveys. That was the bottom line.
Well, and there's truth to that. And the other problem that I have is this. On one hand, you got a survey, and then they basically put their thumb in the wind as council members and decide based on the survey results they're going to vote certain ways and everything else. I think they need to vote based on principle, and whether they agree with my point on principle or your point on principle, even though there's a slight difference here, folks, which is okay, right? They need to vote on principle, not on surveys or not on which way the wind blows. That really... Yeah. Is the point. Let's finish up on Lydia Nettle once again. She has another hit it out of the park point to make.
Yeah, I just have so enjoyed reading her book, Sam. I can't tell you how much I've appreciated the forgotten stories, forgotten American stories. This one's about a poet named Emma Lazarus. Now, you probably won't recognize the name. Very few people would, I suppose, but that is why Lydia put her in chapter 3 of her book. But to understand Emma, we must understand Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty that we discussed last week, right? So I'm not going to belabor that too much, but basically Ellis Island is significant to millions of Americans because it was the golden door to America. Between 1892 and 1954, that was over 60 years, folks, over 12 million immigrants came through those golden doors to America. I mean, that's significant. Over 40% of Americans can trace their roots to Ellis Island. And then she really, I love reading her description of Ellis Island. Immigrants came wearing their native costumes and carried bundles, baskets, trunks, and suitcases containing whatever necessities and precious possessions they could manage. Some traveled alone. Some traveled as families carrying infants with little children in tow. And others traveled as partial families anxious to finally reunite with loved ones or relatives already waiting for them in America. Many came to this strange new land not knowing a soul, not knowing English, and with little money because they sold everything they owned to pay for passage across the Atlantic to America, the golden land of opportunity. But the voyage was no picnic. Many of them were crammed into steerage, the lowest level of the ship, packed like sardines for the three-week voyage. They had no privacy, little comfort, and poor food. Their typical diet consisted of black bread, boiled potatoes, and watery soup. The stench was horrible from few toilets, so many unwashed bodies, because they saved the precious water on board for drinking, and because of the seasickness that afflicted many of them. Well, Sam, Lydia continues to write about the Ellis Island experience. I just love reading it. Why did the immigrants come? She summarizes this with some bullet points. They came for the opportunity to experience religious and political freedom. They came for the opportunity to own their own land. They came for the opportunity to work and to prosper and to live in peace. So where does Emma Lazarus come into the picture? Well, her Jewish ancestors immigrated to America in the mid-1600s. Emma was born in America around 1849. Her father was a prosperous sugar refinery owner in New York and was able to provide an excellent childhood education for Emma through private tutors. She published her first book of poems at the age of 16. And then, in her 20s, Emma witnessed a flood of Jewish immigrants from Russia, escaping the horror of their country's anti-Semitic persecution and pogroms. Because of her concern for the plight of these Jews, Emma became active in the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. Now, in 1883, as we mentioned last week, there are numerous artists, writers, and poets were invited to donate their work to be auctioned to raise money for the construction of the pedestal on which the Statue of Liberty would stand. And although it was typical for Emma to write and rewrite her poems over and over again until they met her meticulous satisfaction, she wrote a poem entitled The New Colossus in one sitting and never felt the need to rewrite that sonnet. She died of cancer 4 years later at the age of 38, Sam. Now, her poem did not become well known until 1903, but at that time, a plaque was placed on a wall inside the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty with her poem, The New Colossus, inscribed on the plaque. And so today, the last lines of her poem are well known, and it provides inspiration around the world. Here is her sonnet, Sam, The New Colossus. Quote, "Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gate shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome, her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp," cries she with silent lips. "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." End of quote.
And the golden door, Sam, is a delightful, interesting phrase highlighting that, folks, we reject illegal activity of any kind, including immigration. However, we do have a golden door, and we do celebrate people wanting to come to this country for the right reasons, for the right purposes, for the purposes outlined by Lydia above. You want to learn more about Lydia Nettle, her incredible book, her Ask an Immigrant podcast, and more? LovingLiberty.net is where you go. You can get a hold of her. She does some incredible work. She's also doing some amazing educational classes and instruction and syllabus, etc., for Liberty Village. We're really doing some phenomenal stuff with Lydia Nettle. LovingLiberty.net, check it out. Lowell Nelson, CampaignForLiberty.org, thank you so much. RonPaulInstitute.org, always doing a phenomenal job. For Lowell, Sam, Dr. Scott Bradley, Lydia Nettle, and many others, Ron Paul, Judge Napolitano. I mean, I can keep going, right? God save the Republic of the United States of America.